This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Toward the end of last year, we turned to you and asked what topics you wanted to hear about. One of the most popular suggestions was made by Brett. He wanted to explore the needs of the profoundly gifted after he heard a show we did on autism.
Brett from Indianapolis. I was listening to your program on autism, and it made me think of the profoundly gifted community and how underserved, underfunded, underutilized, and misunderstood it is. These kids may have high IQs, and they may have the potential to do great things, but they also face many challenges, be it social, emotional, financial, etc. In my experience, not one of these kids is being served. If they are, it's because their parents have fought tooth and nail to get them everything that they can.
Brett, thanks for that suggestion. It got voted up by our audience, and so today we will dive deeper into that. Who are the profoundly gifted? What are some of the stereotypes we think of when high intelligence comes to mind? And are those stereotypes keeping us from identifying and helping young people who need the help? Joining us to discuss it from NPR in New York is Anya Kamenetz, an education reporter for NPR, and the author of the book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Anya, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you.
Joining us from Vancouver is Patricia Susan Jackson, the founder of the Damon Institute for the Highly Gifted. Sue, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And joining us from New Haven, Connecticut is Jonathan Plucker, the president-elect of the National Association for Gifted Children. Jonathan, glad to have you with us.
Good morning.
We're also glad to have gotten your responses to this prompt. We heard from a lot of you when we asked you to share your experiences with being profoundly gifted. Here is some of what several of you left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Fran, and I'm from Pennsylvania, and I'm the parent of a profoundly gifted kid. More than anything else, my kid wants to fit in. He wants to be understood in terms of what he needs in order to learn. He still wants to talk about sports and games and his favorite movies, but he wants to be challenged in class. Not all profoundly gifted kids fit stereotypes that you may see on TV and in the movies. Instead, they may be just like every other kid. They just need a little more attention, and they need someone to address their needs.
Hi, my name is Stacy. I'm in the Los Angeles area. My daughter was tested at 6 years old and was found to be profoundly gifted. Before that, we just thought she was smart, but she was getting depressed as a six-year-old. So we had her tested and discovered that she is PG, and we just started throwing everything, especially math and science, at her. And she can work 4 or 5 grades above her grade level if she's fed the material. She doesn't really seek it, but she does so well when it's given to her, and she really is unhappy if she doesn't have work at that level.
Ryan in Canton, Ohio. As far as being a gifted person, it just kind of paralyzes you. I was told I would be an aeronautical engineer in 6th grade. Since then, I've been a barista, a donut factory worker, a tech support guru with various cable companies. None of these are jobs I've wanted to have. But I've been too paralyzed by my own self-doubt to really pursue anything meaningful. I'm trying to change that now that I'm getting to be in my mid-30s. But I don't know that intelligence is necessarily a good thing for any of humanity. Ignorance is bliss, and I wish I had some.
Thank you all for sharing your stories with us. And Sue, you could kind of hear Ryan's sadness in that last clip. I wonder if you get the sense that people really understand what it's like being profoundly gifted from the perspective of the profoundly gifted, that life is not just this primrose path.
No, it's certainly not. And I think the exceptional sensitivity and perceptual awareness is a double-edged sword, because you're very aware that you are being maybe completely misunderstood, miscued, misserved, a lot of misses, and yet you also want to be able to contribute. So it can have this real enfolding kind of feeling, the exact feeling that Brian was putting forward.
Jonathan, I wonder if we could speak before we dive too deep into this conversation to the rest of us who are not noted as being profoundly gifted, who aren't necessarily sold. I mean, I understand it's difficult being super smart, but poor baby. Like, what? How life must be awful for you. What difference should it make to someone who is not profoundly gifted that someone who is super smart is struggling with life? Why should the rest of us even care?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I guess I would rephrase it a little bit and say, think about it less as, you know, why should we worry about the super smart? But, why is talent important? We all value talent, whether it's our own talent, the talents of our children, our spouses, our partners, our community members. But what sort of a world would it be if no one really had the chance to develop and really capitalize on their talent? We would all suffer from that. I think at the same time, your question sort of begs the issue of the stereotype that we always run into, which is these really talented kids can take care of themselves. We have lots of data now that that simply shows that that is not accurate. Especially for low-income students, African-American students, Hispanic students. Being very talented doesn't mean that you've been given this great sort of blank check for life. It means you have specific needs. And I have to say, it was really hard to listen to those messages. I heard, exhausted, burnt-out parents. Ryan at the end, just trying to find himself, hasn't had very good support. We all suffer when those things happen.
Anya Kamenetz, let's define that term. When we say profoundly gifted, what exactly are we talking about? Is it just an IQ score? Is it an SAT score? What exactly is it?
Well, it's important to try to define our terms, but unfortunately, we're kind of beholden to the results of standardized tests, which do have a lot of weaknesses, especially when it comes to class and race and educational background. You know, there's issues identifying children when they're very young because it's often a factor of their home environment. However, as kids get older, IQ tests are not as useful because there's not as much headroom on the test. You know, it's like trying to measure a 6-foot person with a 5-foot ruler. But, you know, if we're going to be like, you know, rough and dirty as we have to be when we're, dealing with large populations, we talk about the 1% and the 3% of the most high scorers. That's how, for example, New York City does it, the 3% highest scores on tests, which can be an IQ test. It often has verbal and nonverbal components. Other people say best practice is to identify students with interviews and a more robust and multidimensional ways of identifying. But, it's a small percentage of kids who really are very far out there on that bell curve.
Are there different kinds of being profoundly gifted? I mean, it seems like you could be profoundly gifted, say, at music, but not necessarily be profoundly gifted at the humanities or
Absolutely.
At the sciences. Is there any kind of educational provision for different kinds of giftedness, or are we just talking about overall academic aptitude?
I mean, really, it's kind of ad hoc. Like the things that you mentioned, obviously, people have noted that mathematics and music are things that people show an aptitude for very, very early. So is athletics, frankly, and physical pursuits. When you talk about being a great novelist or a great appreciator of art, that's something that can take a lifetime to develop. And you see people making very incredible contributions in their 70s and 80s. So, academic achievement is really only one dimension of this, and again shows how our education system is so inadequate to the needs and the special talents that people have, where we also talk about children that are twice exceptional. You know, they may be dealing with an intellectual disability in one dimension, even as they are off the charts on high level in another dimension.
We are talking about the travails of the profoundly gifted with NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz, Patricia Susan Jackson, the founder and director of the Damon Institute for the Highly Gifted, Jonathan Plucker, the president-elect of the National Association for Gifted Children, and with you. We'd love to hear your experiences about getting resources as, or perhaps for, a profoundly gifted person. 1A@WAMU.org. Or maybe if you interact with someone who is profoundly gifted, whether formally tested and certified as profoundly gifted or not, What do you experience from the outside? And what questions do you have about how to improve those interactions? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Sue, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but can you give us a sense of how long profound giftedness has even been on our radar? How long have we as a society really been testing for this, looking for this, catering to these kinds of young people? Is this a long history or a short history?
I think it's a relatively short history, and there's a wonderful woman named Lita Hollingworth who did some of the first studies in the 1920s on profound giftedness. And in particular, there's a famous book that she wrote where there was 10 children that she studied in some depth. She was the first person to bring to light the incredible complexity, sensitivity, nuanced understanding, apprehension of these children. Very unfortunately, though, even within the broader world of gifted education, gifted psychology, gifted understanding, there's still all kinds of misunderstanding and lack of attention to the very outliers of outliers.
Regarding the misunderstandings, Sherry via Jacobson wrote, wants to know about what some of the assumptions are that are embedded in this categorization and the diagnostic tools, whether they're class-based, whether gender factors into them. We should also ask whether race factors into them. We'll get into Sherry's question in just a little bit as we continue our conversation about being profoundly gifted. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you. You are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. I gotta say, I'm really surprised by some of the stories that you have sent in to us about what it's like being profoundly gifted. Some of them are really, gosh, they just break your heart. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of your stories and getting a little more understanding with Sue Jackson of the Damon Institute for the Highly Gifted, Jonathan Plucker from the National Association for Gifted Children, and NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz. Aaron wrote on our website, the1a.org, I have a nephew who seems to fit the PG profile, PG, profoundly gifted. His parents didn't seem to know how to handle him, so he missed a lot of opportunities. He dropped out of high school during his senior year, partly because he was bored. Now in his mid-20s, he is the manager at a store and seems to be happy with where he is. I sometimes feel sad for him and the opportunities he missed when he was in school. John, how much does Aaron's story fit the profile of a lot of profoundly gifted people that you've interacted with, not necessarily achieving at the level of their potential?
I mean, sadly, it's really not uncommon. But I think when she was talking about her nephew, she really hit on a key thing, which I think all of us have talked about thus far, at least a little bit, which is challenge and support. Can you imagine being a really talented third grader going to school and knowing everything that's not only going to be taught that year, but the next several years? If people aren't specifically worried about your intellectual needs and finding ways to actually challenge you, if we just leave that up to the system, research tells us not much happens. And these kids just sit there bored for years. And I just imagine going to your job every day, whatever, 182 days every single year, and knowing the second that you walk in that you're going to be bored out of your mind. That has obviously huge intellectual consequences. It has huge social consequences, motivational issues, mental health issues. I think it's a much bigger problem than people realize. I would take slight issue with the estimate before of like 1 to 3%. That's one way of looking at it. Some of my colleagues and I did a study last year, and we found that the number of students in reading who were showing up in school the first day already performing at least 4 grade levels ahead was closer to 10 to 15%.
Wow.
This is not a small number of students. And again, that's performance. Not all the students who have potential to do it but aren't supported, that number could be twice as high potentially. That's a lot of lost talent, and that's a lot of frustration.
Susie wrote on our website, the1a.org, while my son needs to be fully engaged, working years ahead, his teachers wanted him in a box. Sit still, conform, learn to stand in a line to become a worker. Two schools, three teachers, multiple administrations do not understand and have compassion for the asynchronicity of the gifted child. I had no choice but to homeschool. I am alone. Sue Jackson, could you respond to Susie's note, including this idea of asynchronicity? Could you explain that?
Well, first of all, oh my gosh, Susie, I can so relate. That's really awful for you. The profoundly gifted child is a child with extraordinary innate capacity along many, many streams of functioning, cognitive, emotional, communicative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they sit most of the time, if they're in a brick and mortar school, an undifferentiated school, even one that's been mildly adapted, working at 4 to 5 grades below what they're capable of. And there's an adage in the profoundly gifted world called once is a pattern, meaning that these children are so able to apprehend stimuli and metabolize stimuli that within maybe a day of being in school, they realize the very thing that Jonathan was just talking about, that sort of endless path ahead with no stimulation. And so they begin to sort of shut down in all kinds of ways. So what we get is a child who's really, really sort of tamping on the brake while they're trying to tamp on the accelerator, and all these aspects of them end up working at all different levels. So they may not have any opportunity to be with another profoundly gifted child. So eventually their social emotional skills atrophy very, very quickly. So they can become very, very sort of disengaged social and emotionally, where intellectually they're still maybe able to perform. So you start to get this asynchrony, these vast differences in their functioning. It's not in their innate capacities. It's when we don't respond to them, they begin to develop extreme anxiety, depression, all kinds of other things. And we're not even getting into the other subject of asynchronicity, which is twice exceptionality, which means they are both profoundly gifted and they have an area that is a cognitive weakness, something they're maybe not as good at. It could be mathematics, it could be decoding, the ability to translate language. So they can be exceptionally bright, but have difficulties with some aspect of processing, which oftentimes teachers are highly perplexed by.
Mm-hmm. I wonder though, Sue, on the flip side of Susie's comment, I wonder how much, and I noticed that Susie said that she had no choice but to homeschool her child. I wonder how much of this lands on parents. I mean, I did gifted classes as a kid, not profoundly gifted, but just plain old run-of-the-mill gifted. And I made it through school partly because my mother made it really, really clear, you are going to behave in school or I will kill you. And there was just no question that I needed to put up with this. Yes, the system is not programmed for you. Guess what? You're a black boy in America. This country isn't programmed for you, and you're going to endure and be fine, and we are going to defend you, but you have to learn how to put up with this. How much of this do we put on the schools, and how much of it do we put on the parents?
Well, I think the first point to be made is the great, great, great diversity in the profoundly gifted population, not just in their profiles that we were just talking about, their cognitive profile, their emotional profile, but also in their personality and in their home lives. So different children come into the world with different levels of resiliency. And I definitely agree that parents should have a high degree of expectation for children. There are profoundly gifted children who literally are absolutely shut down and unable to perform in a public system environment, no matter how much they have, as in your case, healthy expectations, because it just does not work for them. So for every profoundly gifted child, there's a different sort of spectrum of how they're going to respond. And I need to introduce another concept. We know neurologically that the profoundly gifted are very different from even the more moderately gifted. They have a very high level of something called overexcitabilities, which means a high neurological response to stimuli. So they're extremely responsive to what is happening around them. And as I say, each one of them will handle that differently, but some would be absolutely confounded by your mother's advice. It would not work for them.
With regards to race, I wonder, Anya, if you could speak to this email we got from Mackenzie, who wrote, I'm a 28-year-old African-American woman who was discovered to be profoundly gifted at age 6. I grew up in a mostly white suburban area of Orlando, Florida, so I was fortunate that some resources were available when I was younger. However, I discovered that as I got older, fewer and fewer resources were available. The attitude was that I should be able to figure everything out, and I shouldn't need any assistance. Although I scored high in mathematics on standardized tests, I struggled all throughout high school. Anya, it sounds like there is a number of things factoring in Mackenzie's story, not only race, but then the different ways she was treated as she began to age out of the system.
It's really upsetting to hear this, and it's very common. As you look around the country, you'll see that when gifted programs are segregated classrooms, in other words, when they're grouping gifted kids together, they also tend to be racially segregated, and that is because of differences in the likelihood of children who are not white being identified as gifted, and that's because of flaws in how we identify them. Because if you rely on teacher recommendations, oftentimes it's been documented that that white teachers are less likely to see black students as gifted. When they're English language learners, they're less likely to be identified because of that barrier. When parents are not able to advocate for students on the highest level, we heard how much work it can be when you have a gifted kid to try to get them the resources that they deserve. So these issues are all across the board. And then on top of that, most of the action in gifted programs, in gifted education, rather, happens in the elementary level. And when it gets to middle school and high school, it's just a very different picture. It's no longer about necessarily separating those students into a separate stream. On the one hand, it can be good because it's easier to accelerate kids if they're taking, you know, different classes at different times. You can put them into advanced math, for example. On the other hand, you know, making sure that all of the benefits and all of the power of being called gifted, you know, is backed up with support and challenge, as Jonathan said. I think, you know, there's so many gaps in that system.
To back up to Sherry's question that we asked earlier in the program, Sherry was asking about the instruments that are used to measure profound giftedness. What assumptions are embedded in this category and the diagnostic tools? Are they gendered or class-based? Anya, what about the tools that are used to determine whether a child is profoundly gifted? How much do those cultural biases come out in the instruments?
Well, they're baked in from the beginning. I mean, the concept of IQ really dates back to the 19th century and some of the worst racist ideology that's in Western civilization. The very notion of some people being born special is just so fraught. And the instruments that we have tend to be based on IQ scores and IQ tests, you know, and any test that has sort of a normal distribution in its scoring tends to be fraught with these problems. You'll see differences in how students perform that are very indexed to income, to parents' education, and to race. And so with those flaws that are categorical in these types of tests, you know, as flawed as we are, they're sort of the best things that we have to try to identify kids. You know, you can't just base it on the way that they achieve academically because, you know, there are differences in that as well. And obviously teacher reports can also be biased. So there's bias all along the system. I think best practice is to use as many tools as possible and to give students multiple opportunities to be identified. And frankly, you know, all of this emphasis on diagnosis is a little bit of a red herring, too, because the point is once you have recognized kids as having special tools and talents, what are you going to do with them? That's really the question.
We have been getting a number of voicemails from parents who had questions about what to do with their kids who may or may not be profoundly gifted. Jonathan, I wonder what your response would be to this caller whose daughter was almost misdiagnosed with something very different. Here is what she left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I'm calling from the Phoenix area, and my daughter has been identified as profoundly gifted. And how has it helped? Well, the evaluation turned our world around because we thought we were seeing some ADHD traits. And it turns out that what we were seeing is just It appears to be common traits in the profoundly gifted population, especially if they are not in an appropriate educational environment, which our daughter was not at the time. And it's helped by preventing us from going down that wrong path of an ADHD diagnosis, maybe medication, things like that. And by giving us insights into asynchronous development and overexcitabilities. But ultimately, it's still rare enough that it's really hard to know just what to do now that we do know that she's profoundly gifted. So where do we go now?
Hey, Anne, thanks for your message. Jonathan, what would you say to Anne?
Well, unfortunately, Anne's family's situation is fairly typical in this country. She raises a really good point in that many of the characteristics of an extremely bored student who has not been challenged at all are going to look a lot like, you know, attention disorders, Asperger's and things like that. You have to be really careful to make sure that you're separating those things out. And as everyone has said, we have twice exceptional students, many of them. But it's really easy to sort of conflate weakness with great strength, which is kind of a paradox, I think. I think for any parent in Anne's family's situation, any form of academic acceleration. It doesn't have to be grade skipping, which is traditionally how people think about it. There are over 20 different forms of acceleration. Just finding ways to make sure that the student's curriculum and the student's instruction is more closely matching the actual speed with which they can learn. For example, we would never do this to a very good youth athlete, or it would be very, very rare. If we have someone who can play at a very high level, if they can hit a three-pointer at the age of 7, we don't say to them, you know what, you're way ahead of everybody else. Just do layups the rest of the season.
Right, ease up on the threes.
Do that, right?
Yeah,
that's crazy. So that's for in school. As many of your callers have already said, that can be a really heavy lift because most educators have no background and no education, no training, and actually working with gifted students. That's really important to be thinking about.
Well, but John, hold on just 1 second. It's the sure. point that you brought up, and I know we have to pause in just a minute, but the point you brought up with regard to shooting threes, you know, if you're a kid who's great at shooting threes, we're not going to tell you to just shoot layups because you want to be the next Stephen Curry. Like, you can envision right. yourself being something that society venerates in that kind of giftedness. Sue, how much of this do you think is societal? I mean, I don't know what you think about how pop culture depicts the profoundly gifted, but, you know, whether it's Dr. House or Sheldon from Big Bang or Spock from Star Trek, you know, the way that we envision people who are super gifted is not always a noble depiction.
No, I don't think it is, and I have compassion for that. While I want to continue, you know, fiercely to advocate for the great, great, great diversity in this population, I happen to catch a little bit of the Big Bang Theory. I don't watch TV at all, but I caught a little bit of it, and I saw this Sheldon, who's this archetype, like that sort of like over intellectualized, cognicentric, stuck in his head kind of guy, uncomfortable with emotions. Maybe there are definitely some kids in our population that are like that, but there's just such wide, wide diversity, including the kids that are that profoundly gifted athlete, as well as being a profoundly gifted in other manners. If we look at the area of visual arts, for instance, that's an area that's been very, very underserved and misunderstood on the profoundly gifted level. We haven't paid enough attention to that with our emphasis on the psychometric or the testing. We're not catching those kids early and knowing what to do with them. There's just enormous, enormous diversity in how these kids right. present. And I want to make one last point on that.
Briefly.
And that is that they don't always present who they really are. They're very multi-layered kids. And that is very, very confounding to both psychologists and to teachers.
It's interesting you bring that up. When we come back, I'd love to address a comment from our Facebook page. Joanna asks about her child, who she writes, "I just wish I knew how to make her aware that being smart outside the home is okay, but she just wants to be like everybody else. That really worries me. How do we convince profoundly gifted kids that it is okay to be smart and it's okay to be who you are? What do we do? Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with a program we're working on about the Ku Klux Klan. Author Linda Gordon has written a new book chronicling the Klan's return to prominence beginning back in the 1920s. In the last few years, we have also seen a resurgence of white nationalist hate groups in national conversations. If you have ever had an encounter or an experience with the Ku Klux Klan or another hate group, or if you know someone who used to be in such a group, we would love you to leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. We're looking for folks who've had experiences with white nationalist groups like the Ku Klux Klan. If either you or someone you know was in a group like this, tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz, Jonathan Plucker of the National Association for Gifted Children, and Patricia Susan Jackson of the Damon Institute for the Highly Gifted. Joanna wrote on our Facebook page, "I'm not sure if my kid is PG or highly intelligent, but she picked up early on that others were not at her level. Then she became profoundly lazy. She does just enough to be in the top tier. Teachers see how smart she is, but there's no push. She pushes at home. I just wish I knew how to make her aware that being smart outside of the home is okay. But she, quote, just wants to be like everybody else," unquote. Jonathan Plucker, I have to say, this email makes me the saddest of all. Anything that convinces a kid that you just want to blend in with a group and not be who you were meant to be and not shine just makes me sad and angry. What do you do about profoundly gifted kids whose spirits are getting beat down and who are just resigning themselves to being ordinary?
Again, this is fairly common, unfortunately. It really is sad to hear these, even though I've heard them all before. I think part of the peer group issue, I mean, anyone who parents an adolescent knows that you face this paradox, right? They so desperately want to be their own person and they struggle to find their own identity. Now add something like, you know, extreme levels of talent on top of that, it gets more complicated. At the same time, every adolescent wants to feel like they're part of a group, right? So again, it's this amazingly difficult psychological paradox that every talented teen goes through. I think part of it is to think more broadly about who her daughter's peer group is. So for example, I work at Johns Hopkins, and we have the Center for Talented Youth, and we have these summer programs all over the world. What we find after students do these 3-week academic summer programs is that they often leave saying, you know, it was so nice to be around peers who think like I do, who are interested in the same sorts of topics that I am, and they sort of have to go out and find their peer group. So that would be one of my recommendations for Johanna to think beyond school. Maybe it's a weekend program, maybe it's a summer program like CTY, to go out there and help her daughter find these other better role models who are of her same intellectual level. That makes a really big difference.
I wonder, Jonathan, how much social media helps with that. I mean, now it seems easier than ever to find people who are just like you. You just search for them on Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook, and all of a sudden you're not alone anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing to think what many of us, I mean, it is kind of amazing how we all made it through high school without social media, right? But at the same time, I'm so glad we didn't have social media when I was in high school.
Me too.
But I definitely think that once you can help your child find those peers, social media can be a real blessing to help them stay connected 12 months a year.
Margaret emailed, my daughter is a gifted person. And Anya, I wonder if you could answer this one. Margaret emailed, my daughter is a gifted person. She was reading books by herself at age 3, writing complete sentences by age 4. In preschool, however, she did not show the skills because it made her feel different. How can educators identify highly gifted students who are masking their gifts to fit in? Anya?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to give a personal testimonial that CTY was a huge program for me when I was a young teen. And being on a college campus made me realize that there was a reason to keep going and high school and eventually be with peers. You know, we're hearing girls, you know, as a group, tend to be more socially sensitive. And there are unfortunately a lot of stereotypes that stop girls from being the know-it-all, the bossy one, the one who has her answer all the time, you know, something like Tracy Flick in Election. There's a lot of negative stereotypes around girls who are smart and girls who know the answers. And so even at a young age, you know, you have a lot of girls who are sensitive to that and want to conform. And, you know, this is a parenting challenge. I'm the parent of a girl who was tested high, and she has a lot of confidence now. Naturally, she's socially outgoing, and she does want to try to blend in. So you have a choice. You can try to find that more positive peer group. As a parent, you need to get that teacher to see. And a teacher whose experience should know that not every student who's knowledgeable is going to be upfront with that ability. But unfortunately, it's often a parent advocacy issue to try to get students the recognition and the resources they need.
Anya, since you said you went through CTY, can you talk a little bit just briefly about what it was that that program did for you that helped you as a gifted youngster? Was it just being around a peer group? Was it being challenged?
It was diving into a college level topic. I mean, the professors there love teaching and they love condensing a semester long course into 3 intensive weeks. We did archaeology. We were out in the woods doing real archaeological dig. And it was being around other students day and night who were fascinated by science and politics and history and popular music and everything that teens love, and really that enriched environment. I mean, the excitement of it even now. I also attended one that was in rural Louisiana, and that was, if anything, even more special because it was students who were each the smartest student in their small town who were all coming together in this incredible intellectual bonanza.
Anya, one more thing I should ask you to clarify before we move on. We've been talking a lot about IQ testing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We never actually defined what that is, and that's my fault. What exactly is IQ? What does an IQ test actually measure?
Oh, God. I mean, that's such a huge debate. But to say, okay, so basically...
But just the definition of it. What it purports to measure.
Intellectual quotient, right? It's something divided by something else. So what we're looking at is it's often expressed for children in terms of your apparent age and then your actual age. And so someone with an IQ of 200, for example, would be at 5 years old, they would have the intellectual ability of an average 10-year-old. So average IQ is 100. You know, someone who's mentally disabled might be an IQ of 80, and then profoundly gifted. There's a lot of argument. I'd defer to the other two experts here. But so that is what it is. And it is a sum of various types of puzzle type questions and also knowledge based questions. So the IQ test and similar tests are, you know, the items on it can vary based on the age of the person and other factors.
So 100 is a baseline IQ test if your mental age and your chronological age match. But if you are mentally more advanced than a typical person of your age, your IQ would be higher than 100 proportional to your advancement. Is that it?
That's how it makes sense that way for children. You can see how it doesn't really make sense exactly that way for adults. When you get into the IQ for, you know, an adult, it doesn't mean that you're, you know, a 20-year-old is as smart as a 40-year-old. It means that they have, you know, in the middle of the population, how the middle would test would be 100, and then a smaller percentage of people would test 100, 120, 140, and so on.
We heard from a lot of listeners who share sentiments with one of our listeners who left a note for us. Sue, I wonder if you could respond to this voicemail that was left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Tabitha, and I'm calling from Hawaii. I wish people would know that gifted kids, especially kids on the far right in the profoundly gifted and highly gifted areas, don't just have a free ticket in life, that they have to work just as hard, and in some areas harder than a lot of other kids, and that our gifted programs are dramatically underfunded in schools on the wrong notion that if a child is gifted, then they don't need any help and they're going to be just fine. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. a lot of these kids need special attention because they are not necessarily developing in the same order as other children, and they may need some individualized time. And I really wish that our education system could approach them as individuals rather than as a statistic that they unfortunately don't have time or budgeting resources for.
Tabitha, thanks very much for calling in. Sue, what would you say to her?
I think Tabitha's got immense wisdom that the number one thing, and I consult with people literally all over the world in every country, and you have to approach them as individuals, because when you get to the outliers of outliers and the profoundly gifted, not only do they learn in different ways, not only do they have more equipment for thinking and abstracting and creating, but they learn very, very, very differently. Sometimes I talked about once as a pattern. Sometimes they just know things and they don't know how they know them. And so it needs a highly sensitive, nuanced, instructional environment to help that child be able to continue to grow and to learn because of their very unusual ways of knowing. The other thing about the profoundly gifted that is different from the more moderately gifted is they will do deep, deep dives into subject areas to a degree that literally the whole world disappears while they're learning, and their parents and people around them are you know, challenged, I suppose, to help them with these deep dives. So they learn very, very differently. So sometimes where I have found the sort of least support is actually in gifted programs themselves, because they don't just sort of work at a more accelerated pace. They don't just work according to our understanding of cognition. They work in highly idiosyncratic ways, which we're really comfortable with when we think about geniuses that have come before. We're comfortable in talking about them after they're gone, but when they're right in front of us, the complexity and the dynamic quality can be overwhelming for people.
Jill emailed, "My son is graduating this year, and I cannot be more relieved. He began experiencing severe depression in first grade, which led to him being tested as PG. PG children are usually considered a problem as they interrupt the flow in a teacher's attempt to educate. This attitude helps lead to ostracism. In our school system, a child is better off being just above average." Chip emailed, "Profoundly gifted is an odd phrase. It sounds a bit like an illness, profoundly, and praise, gifted. I wonder what your experts think about rebranding this, as folks have with special or exceptional children." Jonathan, what about that? Is this just a matter of calling it something different so it doesn't sound quite so otherworldly and august?
You know, personally, I think that's not a bad idea. I don't use the G word a ton, just because when I'm working with policymakers and certain populations of potential advocates, they don't like the word. So we talk about talent, and everyone thinks talent is important, right? And we talk about highly talented students. And I also don't think it's terribly helpful to differentiate between, to use the terms that we've been using, you know, moderately gifted versus profoundly gifted. A lot of that really comes down to opportunity. And I don't know if a quote unquote moderately gifted student has had the opportunity, support, challenge to really stretch their intellectual legs or their artistic legs, athletic legs.
What is the policymakers don't like about the word gifted, John?
Well, I mean, one, like the person who wrote in said, it has a weird ring to it for lots of people. The second part is, I think we need to acknowledge that historically, many gifted programs, if they weren't intentionally racial segregation vehicles, they certainly looked that way and they kind of worked out that way. I think we've moved far beyond that. We have a long way to go. But to pretend that there's not sort of an ugly history here, too, I think is probably naive.
Andrea emailed, "I'd like to know if any of your guests about profoundly giftedness have opinions on grade skipping." Anya, what about that? What do we know about the impact of skipping grades on profoundly gifted kids?
Skipping grades can be a blunt instrument for acceleration, as was mentioned. There's often, you know, you're almost guaranteed to get a social lag when you're putting kids with others who are much older. You know, sometimes it's the best option available, but, you know, it's also a good idea to look for ways to group children by age as well as ability. Kids have different needs for different areas of their lives. You know, you don't put a kid on a basketball team with kids 3 years older just because they're fast at running, right?
Maybe for a bit more of a nuanced response as we're low on time. Another one of our listeners asked, and Sue, I wonder if you could respond to this. As a parent of a profoundly gifted kid who was also identified as such when a kid, who was also identified as such when I was a kid, I'm curious, what do the most recent studies show is better for gifted kids, academically, socially, and emotionally? Specialized classes for gifted only, a pullout program one day a week, or an all-gifted curriculum versus or mixed classes for students of all levels? Sue, are there certain kinds of approaches to profoundly gifted kids, more immersive, more occasional, that the research shows are most effective for their development? Briefly?
Yes, I think all gifted kids, regardless of their diverse abilities, need time alone, time with other people in the general population, and time with other true peers. And there is no other gifted kid in that needs it more than the profoundly gifted. Their time with true peers in classroom environments or accelerated environments where they're with other people on their capacity level is absolutely life-giving. That said, they need other aspects of them developed in other ways as well. So an all-gifted curriculum is an absolute necessity for a profoundly gifted kid. Opportunities to be with their peers, as I said, and maybe other opportunities to learn broader socialization skills with people who may be their age peers.
Right. And I know that we're very low on time, but Jonathan, if there's a profoundly gifted kid or their parent listening and they're going through this right now and the process just stinks, if they stick it out, if they find the solutions for this, what kind of life can a profoundly gifted kid or parent expect on the other side of this difficult time in their lives? Briefly, before we're out of time.
I believe it's all about life satisfaction, feeling like you're giving back, like you're making a contribution to your family, to society. It's not easy, but it's a much better end zone to cross into if you feel like you're taking advantages of all those talents as opposed to being frustrated like some of your callers have been.
That's Jonathan Plucker, the president-elect of the National Association for Gifted Children. Jonathan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Sue Jackson, the founder and director of the Damon Institute for the Highly Gifted. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you so much.
And NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz. Thank you, Anya.
My pleasure.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.